Hi, today is January 16th, 2022. This is MoViews Podcast 389. Is that right? That sounds right.
That was the next number in sequence from what we have, so I assume that is correct.
And that is the good Dr. John Westfall. I'm Tadu Gasawara. And we're back after a brief hiatus. Was a little busier than I expected to be last weekend. Well, actually, I expected to be busy, but it was even busier than I expected. How's that? Anyway.
But your endeavors went off successfully.
It did, indeed.
So your super secret missions all came off without a hitch.
Yes, thankfully. Very thankfully. Anyhow, so John did a lot of homework.
I did some homework. I there wasn't a ton of tech stuff I thought that was interesting this week, although I did find a very cool piece of software that I'll talk about. But okay. The first thing I found, somewhat weird in my mind, bittersweet, the last MacBook Pro with a DVD drive built in was added to Apple's vintage list this week. It was a 2012 13-inch MacBook Pro. I still have a MacBook Pro sitting over here somewhere with a DVD drive, although it's a 2009. They were obviously gone by mid-2012. Yeah. But it's interesting to me how quickly optical media, DVDs and optical media came in and out of our lives. You know, they kind of hit the mainstream around the mid-90s, and then by 2010, 2011, we're out of it. And we're back to solid state with USB drives or hard drives and magnetic media. So optical media, for all of its, it really did help us a lot in the 90s and 2000s. But then it left real quick.
Well, you know, I guess, and you know, I never really thought about it until you brought it up just now, but it's like the Pony Express, you know, one of my favorite, I guess it's a service, it's not a technology, but the Pony Express was really in service of a technology, which is what most people don't know. It only lasted, I think, 2 years, and its mission in life, literally, was to provide last mile, sometimes more than a mile, of course, but, you know, relatively short distances, like 30 miles or so, between train stations to get messages across until the continental tracks were finally laid. And that took a couple of years. And then it was gone, right? It was it's really, really famous to some of us. Maybe you've never heard of it, John, but people my age.
No, I've heard of it. It's interesting because it still shows up in popular parlance and stuff like that, you know.
Yeah,
people know the term, but it is true. I wonder if 30, 40, 50, 100 years from now we'll talk about, I don't think we'll talk about CDs and DVDs. If anything, we might talk about CDs because they came out, you know, we had them a little bit longer than DVDs. But I guess none of this would have really happened if streaming hadn't if internet bandwidth hadn't gotten to a place where it is. You know, I'm sitting over here, and I actually have a relic of something that shows my laziness, which is sitting on my desk is a Netflix DVD.
Oh, wow.
Because I still actually have a DVD plan. I should actually send this back because it's a movie I actually realized I just watched over Christmas, so I don't need this DVD for any reason. But my wife and I have just been too lazy to cancel our DVD plan, which that was another thing. Netflix raised prices again this week, so I guess we really should become, get on the ball with this and cancel our DVD plan with Netflix so we can pay less overall. But
yeah,
another relic. I actually told someone recently that Netflix used to send DVDs in the mail, and they didn't believe me.
And so you showed them that.
Yeah, they had never heard of that, and I had to tell them. In fact, I was actually going through some stuff I'm looking to get rid of and donate. In fact, if anyone wants an old Xbox 360, please let me know. You've got to pay the shipping, though, for our fives of listeners. But anyway, I found in a box the DVD streaming DVD for a Nintendo Wii.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
So basically, when Netflix came to the Nintendo Wii, you could get a DVD from them that would install it on your Nintendo Wii or let it run off of that, and you could stream your Netflix. That was right when Netflix started their DVD, started becoming streaming.
Yeah.
They were just DVD.
I think there was something similar for the Sony PlayStation. Obviously not the current ones, but one of the older PlayStations. I remembered I had to put a DVD in to not to watch a movie from the DVD, but to enable watching streaming video.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I forgot about that. I was going to say, though, you know, it's funny. You know, my daughter, who's a, what is she, a millennial or something, I guess. She did not want to change from her older MacBook Air, or was it MacBook Pro, to a newer one at one point because it didn't have a DVD
player. Yeah.
And then she didn't want to, and once I convinced her that, you know, okay, I'll get you, this was in college, I think. I got her a external DVD player just in case she ever needed it. I don't think she did. And then when I said, you know, it's time to change your notebook. It's, you know, it's 4 years old now. So let's get you a new one. It's out of warranty. Let's get you a new one. And she says, no, because this one has a SD card slot and a USB type A port, you know. I said, you know, you got to get over this.
Well, you know, I was watching a video by Marcus Brownlee on YouTube, MKBHD, and he was going through his daily carry, and I find that always interesting to see what people carry around. And he was talking about how he has switched to the new 16-inch 2021 MacBook Pro that has US or the SD card reader back in it, and he actually found his external SD card reader in his bag and just kind of threw it off to the side. So I guess I don't need this anymore. And I'm thinking, maybe don't throw that too far. Wait till Apple swings the pendulum the other direction, and
that's
then you'll need it again.
That's right.
But I thought that, you know, and I've actually started carrying around on a little chain a USB A to C converter because my laptop only has USB C drives on it, and I carry around a USB a memory stick that's an A, so I need something if I want to be able to connect up to my own laptop from my own USB drive.
I actually, and this is stupid, I know, but I actually bought USB-C hubs for every portable I have, including all my Chromebooks. So there's one in every bag, basically, so that I always can, you know, read a SD card or plug in a USB-A. I did get my daughter a nice hub, by the way, so she has an SD card reader, a USB-A port, and all the necessities a millennial needs, I guess. But speaking of, you know, new things, okay, so we've been talking about foldable devices. I haven't bought one. I don't think you've bought one.
No, I have not, but they look so tempting. Aren't they? I don't know if it's because they're so cool looking that they fold.
They are.
The only thing that's kept me away from them at this point is the price point. They do tend to be a little more expensive. But this week there were rumors that Google is working on a foldable notebook that they might, you know, call the notebook or notepad or something like that. A notepad is what the foldable might be named. Basically a foldable tablet that would go along with their Pixel as your phone, and then you'd have this tablet. And it started getting me thinking a little bit about, A, would this be something I'm interested in? Who knows? Depends on the price point. And Pixel-branded things, we always know, can be very variable in price points, whether they're reasonable or high, low, whatever Google's feeling that day or that year. But then, you know, we've talked a lot about Apple having a very cohesive ecosystem where you have a MacBook, an iPad, an iPhone, an Apple Watch. Done. Right. Would this actually fill that so that Google could offer the exact same sort of lineup, a Chromebook, a Pixel foldable, a Pixel phone, and a Google Watch? Because we know there's rumors of Google Watches on the horizon.
Coming back.
coming back. And so the question I kind of have is if you could have this full interoperability or as much as possible where, you know, the ecosystems would sync and you'd be able to kind of pick up your Apple devices one day and your Google devices the next day. Would that make you want to have both of them just to be able to play around and try things out? Or would it be the opposite where you go, I've already got that in my other ecosystem. Why bother picking up the Google ecosystem or the Microsoft ecosystem if they were ever to have it again?
Yeah. Well, their Duo, their Android Duo does.
Yeah.
I would get a Neo, though, if it were reasonably priced. But that appears to be, you know, just mythical at this point. Yeah,
I think it's just very interesting the sorts of things that we're going toward, because for a long time, I think there was this resistance over an ecosystem and a walled garden, and Android would even, you know, that was a big selling point of Android. You're not walled in.
Yep.
But it certainly does seem like some people want the walled garden. Apple's ecosystem has been successful, so maybe Google's thinking, if you can't beat them, join them. Have a lineup, have the full lineup, and let people have the whole ecosystem if they want it, versus, oh, if you want a tablet, guess you're going to have to jump over to an iPad, or if you want a watch, you're going to have to get an Apple Watch.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you say that, because when I first saw you put the link in, I thought, oh, you know, the word notepad, right? And I thought notebook, like Chromebook. And, oh, yeah. This isn't a Chrome. It's a phone. You know, it's a really expensive phone that folds. Because, you know, I've been really interested in, multi-screen notebooks, or at least, you know, slate-type devices. I've been kind of looking at the... Is it an Asus? I think it's the Asus ZenBook Duo line for a couple of years now. But the price was supposed to come in at around, I think, $1,200 a couple of CESs ago, but it never appeared, and only the $2,000+ versions there. And I just don't want to spend that kind of money on a Windows device, just because. Actually, I don't want to spend that kind of money on any device. I haven't spent $2,000 on a device in a long time. But it is interesting. I'd be more interested in seeing Google release another slate, you know, like the one that's actually mentioned here, the one-off that they mentioned here. What was it called? I guess it might have been called, was it called a slate? Whatever it was called. The Pixel Slate. That's what it was called. It was just underpowered and too expensive, and hopefully this is not underpowered and too expensive too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, we shall see. The foldables... I hate to say it, I worry that the first foldable I'm going to have is whenever Apple decides to roll it out to an iPhone or an iPad.
You're probably right.
Because if these things do tend to continue to evolve the way they have, it will be one of those things that Apple just waits till the end and grabs it and makes it better, which is kind of sad to say, but if I'm going to get it, I want it to work all the time. I don't want to have to deal with some of the, you know, one of the YouTubers I like to follow is Michael Fisher, who goes by Mr. Mobile. And he likes the foldables, and he's done a lot of reviews on the foldables. But so far, he has not found one of them that is logically coherent in the way that its operating system always works and it's reliable. So it still seems much more faddish than work class. To me.
Yeah, you know, and right now all the foldables have been, I think this is true, have been phones, right? Can you imagine if there was an iPad mini foldable called?
Yeah,
you know,
that would be kind of cool.
Yeah, I mean, you know, whatever they call it, right, the iPad mini infinite or whatever, you have two, what do we have now? I think they're 8-inch diagonal. It's pretty big now.
Yeah, because it's just a hair smaller than the original iPad.
Yeah.
So can you imagine? Think about screen size,
Can you imagine two iPad minis that fold out? I mean, they're really thin. So even if you pancake two of them together, it wouldn't be that thick. And now you would have something that can fit in almost any carry-on bag. You wouldn't need a backpack.
Yeah.
And you would have it'd be really narrow, but you'd have effectively a 16-inch diagonal screen, which is maybe not 16 inches, but it'd be pretty amazing. It'd be, twice as big, right? It'd be bigger than the biggest iPad Pro.
Yeah. So many possibilities in the possible future for these things.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I found a new piece of software that I thought people would be interested in. I was having a conversation with a friend of mine, Matt Rosema, on Monday night this week, and we were talking about Linux administration and sysadmin stuff, and he works an IT job where he's doing quite a bit of admin, and I said something about booting off of a USB drive, and for years I've had a couple of USB recovery drives around that I've installed random things like Pyrens Boot CD and all that. And I typically had used a piece of software called Yumi, Y-U-M-I, that allowed you to install multiple distributions on one USB. Mm-hmm. It would give you, it would partition the USB properly and all of that. And he said, oh, that's nice, but there's an even better solution called Ventoy, V-E-N-T-O-Y. Ventoy gives you the best of both worlds. You install it on your USB drive. It does format the whole drive, so you do lose all your data. You have to move it back. But then it installs a boot manager that will look at your contents of your USB drive and then will put together a dynamic list of all of the ISO files that you have and let you boot directly off of any of those ISOs. So in essence, you can still use your USB drive as a USB drive, but you can at any time drop a new ISO image or disk image on there and boot off of it. So it gives you one drive that can do everything you might need.
That's pretty amazing. You know, back in a day when I did, when I used to do this a lot for some reason, I don't remember why, but I really didn't have big enough USB drives, you know, to fit everything, right? But now, these days, you can literally fit everything. So it'd be pretty amazing. You know, I have not played, aside with my rarely used, Raspberry Pis, I have not installed a Linux distro in many years now. And I used to do it like regularly. So interesting.
If you haven't, if you're bored, do one in virtual drive or virtual box or something like that. Because the installation on Linux, if you're still thinking installation of Linux that was even 10 years ago, it's gotten a lot slicker. It's,
in virtual box?
Yeah. Well, just in general. I mean, if you had hardware too, but if you're still like me and you think of installing Linux as an N-curses, blue and red screen, which I think to some extent I still do, then it's definitely evolved from there.
Yeah, where you had to sort of partially hand code the video driver days.
hope that it would know what you were talking about.
Yeah. Why do I only see a quarter of a screen on my display?
Yeah. Well, hopefully you'll scroll when you move the mouse. Oh, wait, you can't use the mouse because the driver's not there.
Yeah,
okay,
you
have
to put the driver in. Good thing Linux doesn't really need a mouse. But And this is relatively recently updated. It's It was updated January 8th of this year. So.
Yeah, and I installed it this week and got it set up. I carry around, I think I've joked about what I call the world's most boring U.S. or Swiss Army knife.
Right.
It's the version that only has the stuff you'd actually use in a day. So it's got a little pen, it's got a little light, it's got a USB drive, it's got a nail file, it's got a really tiny like letter opener size blade. If you enjoy having something like that on you that you can use, you will enjoy having this tool on it. Todd, I think, is laughing because I've had a cat trying to attack me for the last about 5 minutes.
I wouldn't use the word attack.
Sitting now on my lap. Well, here's your other tech tip. Every time he walks over the keyboard, I throw my mouse into the bottom right corner, which basically locks my screen. So that way I've not had 100 things entered into the show notes. But yeah.
That looks like a pretty happy cat, though.
Yeah. This is Coconut the cat, who will turn 1 year old on January 31st.
I guess Coconut is our guest panelist.
Yeah. I don't know if he has anything to say. He actually can get very vocal, so we'll see. I think he's happy though. So,
oh boy. Okay. We'll need a headshot of Coconut, and we'll put him in the show notes for the blog, or on the blog.
I mean, if you can grab a screen cap right now, we can maybe try to get him to actually look at the screen or.
Okay,
you know.
Hang on. It's what is it? Control Shift 4, right? Control Shift 4.
Mm-hmm.
No. What did I? I can never remember. There we go. Option, Command Shift 4. Okay, can you move Coconut just slightly higher? Oh no, he's not. But he's going to put his head down.
I know. Now he knows that we're onto him. I think.
Come on, Coconut. You can do it, buddy. Is it Coconut a girl or boy? And now he's gone.
He's a boy.
Oh, got him. I got him. I'm so proud. I am now a cat photographer.
Yes. Well, you made the name for yourself in bunny rabbits.
There you go.
And now you've branched out to other mammals.
That's right. I also do dogs, because my neighbors have a lot of dogs. But yes, I'm a multi-mammal photographer. And people. People, too. Okay. Okay, so Ventoid. Ventoid.net will be in the show notes, along with Coconut.
Yep.
All righty. So I've got just two things I wanted to mention, and one is something I ran across. It's by the guy who says that he wrote the first version of Task Manager for Microsoft Windows back in 1994. And the cool thing about it is, you know, aside from a trip down memory lane, is there are things, even though he left Microsoft a while back, I guess, He says, basically, you know, a lot of the stuff that he wrote in there are still there. And so in this Reddit article that he wrote, there's a lot of handy tips that having used Task Manager since 1994, 95, whenever I first saw it. So, you know, well over a quarter century, I did not know this stuff. So, for example, it says, if Task Manager ever hangs or crashes, start another by pressing Control Shift Escape. That's news to me. And yep. It says, we'll log on, we'll look for an existing instance and try to revive it for up to 10 seconds. So, Control Shift Escape if Task Manager hangs. That's pretty cool. He says you can also restart it if it looks like it's become corrupted by pressing Control Alt Shift and Task. Control Alt Shift. And it'll reset all internal settings. Control Alt Shift. So, you know, it's got a couple of things like that, a couple of tips. It's kind of a longish article, actually, and it's very interesting. And apparently, he's also wrote... Oh, but he talks about a game he wrote called Space Cadet Pinball. He says it's still run. You can still... He wrote it for the DOS days, and it's still running Windows 10. He says, I doubt if it's official legal.
Just knowing that Control Shift Escape to open Task Manager would have saved me a lot of time in my past life.
Or even, and I can't say I've ever seen Control, Windows Manager, Task Manager get corrupted, but there were times that it's frozen on me. Well, like lots of times. So, yeah. So, alrighty. There you go. Control Shift Escape. Put that in your memory banks, as they used to say. And the last thing I wanted to note is really, two things really. It's related to my Daily Doodle project. You know, where one of the things that's happened over the last 5 years now that I've been Daily Doodles, I've actually been watching videos and reading things about actual artists, you know, versus doodlers like me, to better understand what it is they do. And if I don't know if you had a chance to go to the Van Gogh experience in your area. It's you're in a giant like warehouse type room with multimedias and all of that. Well, there's one called the Beyond Monet. That's apparently called the Monet Experience. That's going to be traveling the U.S. And, you know, so I started reading a little bit about Monet. I mean, I know who he was, but I started reading a little bit about him and looking at tutorials on how people think his technique worked. And the interesting thing I learned about Monet is the role that technology played in enabling him and his art. For example, trains, which, you know, came in the early part of the 19th century, like 1802, that around then. Trains enabled artists to quickly travel to and fro places where, you know, it would have taken days, weeks, or years to get to previously. And even more important, the paint tube was invented in 1841. Previous to that, artists had to get their own painting, you know, raw materials and grind it up and create their own paints. And then, you know, as soon as you do that, it starts drying. But the paint tubes let you carry your tools with you and allowed, you know, people, artists like Monet, to go to places and set up shop, you know, wherever they were, and draw their ponds and buildings and people and you know, subjects they may not have been able to see if they didn't have a train and paint tubes. So at any rate, I found that really interesting because, you know, it's I don't know if I really don't know if modern serious artists, because I don't really track them. But I don't know if modern serious artists use the iPads, you know, versus people who do commercial artwork, where it makes a lot of sense to use it. But I wonder what the influence of the iPad and other, you know, more modern digital drawing and or even like 3D printer technologies will be viewed in the future. And
you know,
I was just going to say, you put in something in the show link. Oh, I've heard of this. I've not.
Well,
seen
yeah, it. So. You know, technology, it's interesting what we think of as technology. You know, I was teaching a class that was history of psychology last semester. And, you know, in 1600, technology was a daily journal. Like the idea that you actually cared to write down what you were doing and how you were doing it. And these idea of conduct books and things like that, that people would start to, you know, think about their own lives. And that's when we started developing self-concept. And it's just kind of crazy what technology is in any given era. But when you're talking about the Van Gogh experience and the Monet experience, it makes me think of the movie Tim's Vermeer, which came out about 7-8 years ago now, which looked at the founder of the company New Tech, Tim Jennison, talking about and basically documenting his efforts to figure out how it is that the 17th century Dutch painter Johannes Vermeer was able to capture light so well in his paintings at a time when no one else could. No one else kind of knew what light was supposed to look like. And what he actually finds and what he argues is that Vermeer was using the very first instances of something called a camera obscura, which is basically a lens that he would project an actual room into a little box, and he could actually shade whatever colors were coming through that lens. So he actually, throughout the course of the movie, recreates the painting The Music Lesson by Vermeer by actually getting and setting up a room to look like The Music Lesson, and then standing in a little dark box, in essence, letting the image come through the lens, and then matching the pigment, matching the color and the light. So it's a very interesting movie you might find, and you can find it on streaming services. It's been around for a while now, but I found it pretty riveting when I went through it.
And here's a bit of trivia, and John, you're going to have to help my aging memory on this one. In the 1990s, Microsoft had a pretty popular web, like an HTML editor tool, and I just cannot remember for the life of me what it was called.
Microsoft Front Page.
There you go. So, in fact, I'm going to write it down, because otherwise I'm going to forget it again. The interesting thing, John, and you may know this already, Front Page...
I think I know where you're going.
Yeah, was originally called Vermeer.
Yes, Vermeer Front Page. And here's the interesting part about it. Those VTI extensions, when you used Front Page back in the day, you needed to have Front Page extensions installed on your web server. I knew this because I was doing a lot of work for a Windows web hosting company at the time, and man, Front Page extensions were finicky. They could break real easy. And those VTI subdirectories, you would see them on different websites. They were the extensions that allowed you to do things that you would normally need interactive code. You could plop in like a guest book or a bulletin board, that sort of thing. But the way that I find this very interesting is that VTI extensions and all that are still being used by Microsoft today. You will still see them as parts of SharePoint. Some of the technology that Microsoft bought from Vermeer Technologies years ago has now lived on. And even though Front Page is dead and its successor, Microsoft Expression Web, is dead, it lives on in SharePoint. The technology is still there.
Kind of like Windows Task Manager.
Yes.
Which is not dead, but, you know, it's old. And the other thing I remember is, and I wish I'd remembered their names. I met the two guys who created it right after they were bought by Microsoft. Their company was bought by Microsoft. I was a contractor to Microsoft at the time. We were doing the MSN launch, and we were in Redmond. And I remember these two guys came in, and they were, you know, because MSN was, you know, converting at the time from a proprietary display thing like AOL was to a web-based product. And so they brought these two guys in and said, hey, we just bought their company. It's called Front Page. And we'd just like them to talk to you about web development and the tools they're using and the tools we just bought from them. So I actually met those two guys. It was really interesting. This was 1990. Six, something like that. So 25 years ago, I guess, 27 years ago.
It all comes full circle. People wonder how we're able to fill 30 minutes of podcast time on five extra pieces of notes. And this is how it happens.
But once again, we have filled up a whole 30 minutes of notes. Podcast. And we'll get back on track to inviting some guests in. I wasn't sure I was going to be able to make this podcast, so I asked John, and because John is more understanding than other people, if I have to, you know, brush them off and go, something came up. But fortunately, nothing came up this week. And we were able to do our 30 minutes. And I hope our fives of listeners appreciate it and appreciate John for being so tolerant with my weird schedule.
We're all weird in some way. Weird is good.
And you know, in Portland, it sort of says that. What does it say? Home of the weird? Something like that.
But I think it's keep Portland weird.
Keep Portland weird. Yeah, you're right.
In Cleveland, Mississippi, we actually have a campaign that's Keep Cleveland Boring, which is humorous and very accurate.
But at any rate, and we should say it's Portland, Oregon, not Portland, Maine. But anyhow, so that brings, and you know, I keep, you know, thank goodness John tracked it because I couldn't remember which podcast number it was today. John created the show notes for today. Podcast 389, closing in on a 400 this year. We'll talk to you later. My mouse is acting weird. I got to use my trackpad.